visit. Uh-oh. It's always nice to get to visit Johnson and see friends that I don't get to see all that often. Now that my parents actually come here on Wednesday evenings, it's a nice opportunity for them to get to see their grandkids, and so I know that they're looking forward to tonight, probably more for that than to see me, and that's okay. But it's good to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. Earlier this summer, I had the opportunity to speak in a series at another church that was basically focused on villains from the Old Testament, specifically from the divided kingdom. And it was an enjoyable study for me because it was something I really hadn't studied before. And so I decided to use some of that material tonight because I do think it'll be something a little different than what we are used to hearing. Larry, when he invited me, said I can speak on whatever I want to. And so I said, well, maybe this will be something a little bit different. But I hope that it's not just something different, but also something that is very applicable and relevant to you. And I think it will be. I think there's some stuff here that we can take away. Tonight we are going to be talking about King Jeroboam from the Old Testament. His story is told in 1 Kings chapters 12 through 14. So if you have a Bible, I would encourage you to turn there. We will be reading from there some, but I'll be referring to a lot of stuff that goes on there. So 1 Kings chapters 12 through 14. But Jeroboam's story doesn't actually start with Jeroboam. It really starts with King Solomon. And I think that we are probably pretty familiar with Solomon, David's son, the wisest man of them all. He expanded the borders of David's kingdom. He was incredibly wealthy. But we also know that he married many, many foreign women, often for political reasons, to form alliances, but also probably just because he wanted to. And in the latter portion of 1 Kings chapter 11, or at the beginning of 1 Kings 11, I'm sorry, we see that these wives began to turn his heart away from following God, and he began to worship other gods. And because of this, God says that there will be consequences. Out of respect for David, God is not going to divide the kingdom during the days of Solomon, but in the days of Solomon's son, he will. And in the meantime, he's going to raise up adversaries to oppose Solomon, people who are going to irritate him in the closing years of his reign. And so in the latter portion of 1 Kings 11, we're introduced to three specific adversaries that God raises up to oppose Solomon. The first one, this is in chapter 11, verses 14 through 22, is a guy named Hadad the Edomite. This guy had a grudge dating back to David, and he had fled to Egypt where he had married into the royal family, and now he's going to be back and he's going to be kind of an adversary of Solomon. The second guy is named Rezon, the son of Eliada. He was a leader of a band of marauders centered around Damascus, and he just hated Israel. And then the third adversary that God raises up to oppose Solomon is Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And he's the guy that we want to focus on this evening. Unlike the other two, Jeroboam actually starts out as an ally of Solomon. He's an Ephraimite who's capable and industrious, and so Solomon puts him over all of the forced labor in the house of Joseph. And Jeroboam goes out one day, seemingly just a normal day, minding his own business, and a prophet named Ahijah comes up. And Ahijah tears off his robe, and he tears it into 12 pieces, and he gives 10 pieces to Jeroboam, delivering a message that because of Solomon's idolatry, God is going to tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon. He's going to give 10 tribes to Jeroboam. And this is probably a fairly memorable day. I assume that Jeroboam didn't often meet people who would take off their clothes and tear them up and throw them at him. But this is a memorable day where he is promised a kingdom. And then, through Ahijah, God offers a covenant agreement to Jeroboam. God will bless him, he will make him king over Israel and give him all that he desires if he will listen to God's commands and walk in his ways just like David did. And moreover, God promises to build a house or a dynasty like he did for David. And Solomon hears about this somehow, and he decides he wants to kill Jeroboam. He sees him as competition. And so Jeroboam flees to Egypt, and he basically lives there in exile until the death of Solomon. And that brings us to 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12 tells us the story of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, who takes his place on the throne. Rehoboam, as he begins to reign, has a contingent of men who come to him to ask him to lighten the heavy burden of work that Solomon had placed on his people. They say, hey, your dad was really hard on us. Can you lighten up on us a little bit? For our purposes, it's interesting to see that Jeroboam is the man who leads this contingent of people who come to Rehoboam to ask for this lightened load. Jeroboam had returned from exile in Egypt when he heard that Solomon had died, and upon his return, he had been placed in front of this delegation to go to Rehoboam with this request. Now, of course, King Rehoboam is going to get advice from two different sets of men. First, some older men who had been advisors to his father, and they say, hey, this is actually a good idea. Your father was very hard on these people, and if you lighten their load, they will be very loyal to you, and this will be good. Well, then, there are some younger guys who are Rehoboam's contemporaries, I guess guys that he grew up with, and they come and they say, no, this is not what you do. You say, when these people come to you to ask to lighten the load, what you say is, you think my father was tough, wait until you get a load of me, because I'm gonna be way tougher than he ever was. Well, he goes with the advice from the younger men, and certainly this is a foolish decision that Rehoboam makes, but the narrator of Kings makes sure to tell us that this is not just some random foolish decision. God was working through this situation to bring about the division of the kingdom that he had already promised to Jeroboam in the previous chapter. And the response from the people is predictable. A 10-tribe majority rebels against Rehoboam and makes Jeroboam their king. Originally, when this happens, Rehoboam musters his army, and he's going to go out and fight this civil war to try to get these 10 tribes back. But he changes his mind after he receives a message from the prophet Shemaiah saying that he is not to fight against his relatives because this is God's will that this happens. And so Rehoboam goes back home. And we have two new nations, two kingdoms, the southern kingdom of Judah, and now the new northern kingdom of Israel, over whom Jeroboam becomes king in about 930 BC. And he's going to reign in that capacity for about 22 years. Now, before we go on in the story, I think at this point, we would do well to pause for a moment and reflect on Jeroboam's rise to power. We know that Jeroboam was a capable and skilled man. He had been placed over all of the forced labor of the house of Joseph. But this hardly was the means by which people came to power in the ancient world. Just because he had some ability, that doesn't get you to be king. He was not from a royal family. He was not the head of a conquering army. As we see through the prophecies of Ahijah and Shemaiah, Jeroboam's rise to power was the work of God's providential hand. And Jeroboam knew this. And yet, as soon as he sits down on the throne, Jeroboam's thinking seems to shift from providential to pragmatic. The question Jeroboam asks himself is, what do I need to do to stay in power? And ironically, he already had the answer. God already told him everything he needed to know to stay in power. Be faithful to me, and I'll bless you. I'll make a house, a dynasty out of your name, if you'll just listen to my commands and walk in the ways like David did. But Jeroboam ignores that answer, and he pursues his own plans instead. Immediately, he fortifies his capital city at Shechem, and he does the same at Penuel, which is another city located about 5 miles west of the Jordan River. And this would have offered kind of a first line of protection against potential threats to the east. Well, neither of these acts are problematic in and of themselves, but the next thing that Jeroboam does is a major, major problem. He reasons that if his people return to Jerusalem to worship at the temple like they are supposed to, that they will be tempted to return to Judah. Their hearts will turn back to Rehoboam, and they'll want to serve him again, and they'll leave Jeroboam, they'll leave Israel, and they'll want to go back and be united with Judah. And he'll get overthrown. So he's afraid of this. So Jeroboam gets what he thinks is a brilliant idea, and he makes two golden calves. He sets one up in Bethel and the other in Dan, representing the northern and southern extent of the northern kingdom. Dan is way up north and Bethel's in the south, and so you have these two convenient worship locations with these golden calves. Scholars disagree and debate about whether or not Jeroboam is trying to get the Israelites to worship another god by doing this, or rather if he's just simply introducing an innovation in the way in which they're supposed to worship Jehovah or Yahweh? I tend to think that it's the latter, but the reality is that calves are so closely tied to pagan Canaanite religion that it's really hard to be sure. But either way, it doesn't really matter. Even if Jeroboam was not setting up worship of another new god and thus violating the first commandment, he was still guilty of creating an image to serve the true God and thus violating the second commandment. Either way, at the very least, he perverted the worship of the true God. And Jeroboam's disregard for the religious statutes that God had set up don't end here. He also set up alternate worship sites on high places at Dan and Bethel. He put in place priests who were not from the tribe of Levi, and he instituted his own feast day. Each of these actions defied and broke God-given requirements in the law and implied that civil matters were more important than religious principle and practice. Jeroboam has not been on the throne long, but he's already dramatically departed from God's instructions to walk in all of his ways like David did. Instead, Jeroboam seems to have forgotten who placed him on the throne in the first place. And rather than obey the real power behind the throne, God, he takes matters into his own hands to try to secure his own power. So that brings us now to 1 Kings chapter 13, which is really just a continuation of the story from chapter 12. This is probably not a great place for a chapter break. We know that when Scripture was originally written, it was not in chapters. Those were added later, and sometimes they're very helpful, and sometimes they're not very helpful. And this is an instance where this chapter break is not super helpful because it interrupts this ongoing story. It makes it seem like it's two different stories. But we've just heard that Jeroboam has made a new feast and that he went up to the altar to make offerings, and a prophet from Judah comes to Bethel, and as Jeroboam prepares to make offerings on the altar, this prophet cries out against it. 1 Kings chapter 13, starting in verse 2. This prophet says, "O altar, altar, thus says the Lord God, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you, and human bones shall be burned on you." And he gave a sign the same day, saying, "This is the sign that the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be torn down, and the ashes that are on it shall be poured out." Not surprisingly, Jeroboam is not a huge fan of this message that he gets from this prophet. And so he stretches out his hand and says, "Seize him." But as soon as this happens, verse 4 says that his hand dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. So ironically, in this very act where he's trying to assert his power over this prophet, he is shown to be powerless, and he actually lends credibility to this prophecy. He shows that there's some power behind this prophet because his hand is shriveled up. And then the altar was torn down, as the prophecy said. And so Jeroboam asked the prophet to entreat God on his behalf that his hand might be restored. The prophet does so, and Jeroboam is healed. Well, Jeroboam is probably grateful that he's now received this healing from this prophet, and so he invites the guy over for dinner. But the prophet refuses because God had commanded him to return directly home as soon as he gave this prophecy. Don't stay and eat there. Don't do anything else. Come directly home. Maybe dining with the king would have made it seem like he was approving of the wicked things that Jeroboam was doing. We don't really know. We just know that God told him not to do it. And so he says, "No, I can't stay. I got to go home." Well, here the narrative takes leave of Jeroboam, and it follows this young prophet and his strange interaction with an older prophet from Bethel. The young prophet is from Judah in the south. The old prophet is from Bethel, from Israel in the north. Well, since our focus is on Jeroboam, we won't dwell on this story in detail, but it's a tragic story, this young prophet from Judah being deceived by the older prophet from Israel into disobeying God, and he dies as a result. And this may seem like kind of a strange, random story to include in this bigger narrative of Jeroboam, but it reinforces the idea that God expects to be obeyed, and severe consequences come for those who just do whatever they want and disobey God, disregard what he says. But Jeroboam doesn't take heed of this warning. Regardless of this cautionary tale of the young prophet, 1 Kings chapter 13 ends by saying this. Verse 33, "After this thing, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil way, but made priests for the high places again from among all the people. Any who would, he ordained to be priests of the high places. And this thing became sin to the house of Jeroboam, so as to cut it off and to destroy it from the face of the earth. So this story also shows us that Jeroboam remains unrepentant. He is determined to continue on this course, determined to continue to disobey God, come what may. Well, soon after this, Jeroboam's son Abijah, whose age we do not know, becomes sick. And this story is told in 1 Kings chapter 14. So we're now in chapter 14. Jeroboam decides to send his wife to visit the prophet Ahijah to find out what will happen to their son. Now, this is confusing. His son is Abijah. The prophet is Ahijah. So she's going to go see Ahijah to find out about Abijah. All right? Now, Ahijah, you might remember, because he's the prophet who earlier took off his robe and tore it up into pieces and gave 10 of them to Jeroboam. So this is a guy that Jeroboam seems to have some faith in. And interestingly, Jeroboam sends his wife in disguise, hoping that Ahijah, who's now old, maybe won't be able to see very well and won't figure out who it is. I guess Jeroboam, you know, he knows that he's not doing the right thing, and he probably thinks that this prophet of God will not be super inclined to help him. So he's going to send his wife in disguise. And it's kind of ironic because Jeroboam and his wife are hoping that Ahijah the prophet will be perceptive enough to tell them what the future holds for their son. But at the same time, he's hoping that Ahijah the old man will be not perceptive enough to realize that this is actually Mrs. Jeroboam in disguise. But regardless, God reveals who it is that Ahijah is talking to, and he sees through the disguise, and then he delivers a difficult message to Jeroboam's wife. This is kind of an important passage. I'm going to read this starting in chapter 14, verse 7. This is Ahijah the prophet speaking to Jeroboam's wife. "Go tell Jeroboam, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, and yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my eyes, but you have done evil above all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, provoking me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. Therefore, behold, I will bring harm upon the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free in Israel, and will burn up the house of Jeroboam as a man burns up dung until it is all gone. Any belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and anyone who dies in the open country, the birds of the heaven shall eat, for the Lord has spoken it. Arise, therefore, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. And all Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave, because in him there is found something pleasing to the Lord, the God of Israel, and the house of Jeroboam. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam today. And henceforth the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water and root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their fathers and scatter them beyond the Euphrates because they have made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam which he sinned and made Israel to sin. Then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed and came to Tirzah. And as she came to the threshold of the house, the child died. And all Israel buried him and mourned for him, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the prophet." Ahijah tells Mrs. Jeroboam that God had exalted her husband and made him king, but instead of following in David's footsteps and following God, he incited the wrath of heaven by leading the northern kingdom into idolatry instead. Because of this, judgment has been pronounced not just on Jeroboam, but every male of his house, his dynasty, his line is going to be wiped out. And not just that, the entire kingdom of Israel is going to come to ruin far in the future. Concerning the sixth son, Abijah, who they came to ask about in the first place, the child will die as soon as Jeroboam's wife returns to the city. But because the Lord is pleased with the child, verse 13 tells us this, it doesn't tell us why, Abijah will be granted a measure of grace. Of all of Jeroboam's household, he alone would be given a proper burial, which was a major concern in the ancient world because a person's method of burial was believed to be related to that person's experience in the afterlife. And so young Abijah, he'll get to be buried at least, but the house, the dynasty of Jeroboam is going to be wiped out completely. And that's basically what we know about Jeroboam. There's A little bit more about him in the book of Chronicles. We know that he was a man of war, that he warred constantly with Rehoboam in the south. He also fought against Rehoboam's son, who was also named Abijah, which is continues to be confusing. Was defeated by him, according to 2 Chronicles chapter 13, and he never recovered the level of power that he had had before that. That's King Jeroboam. So what can we learn from the story of Jeroboam? How do we apply his story to our own lives beyond simply saying, well, that Jeroboam, he was a bad guy, we should not be like him? I think that there are probably many principles that we could glean from his life, but as we close this evening, I've put together three major lessons that I think we can take away from the story of Jeroboam. Number one, Jeroboam's life is a story of the long-lasting effects of disobedience. Jeroboam chose to disobey God, to lead his people in a different direction, to introduce religious innovations, and the result was long-lasting, devastating consequences. It led to the downfall of his own reign, the destruction of his dynasty, and ultimately it set the northern kingdom of Israel on a path toward destruction. In the theology of the Old Testament and in the books of 1 and 2 Kings, it was the king's job to be devoted to God and to lead his people to be devoted to God. And this is the basis upon which kings were evaluated. Not their military achievements or whether or not they expanded the kingdom or anything else, but were they faithful to God and therefore did they lead their people to be faithful to God? Kings who were disobedient led their people to sin and were considered to be absolute, abject failures. Jeroboam's sin led to the people sinning as they participated in the sinful worship practices that he initiated. Later on, when other kings are evaluated, they are compared to Jeroboam. He kind of becomes the standard for bad kings. Over and over again, reference is made to Jeroboam and the sin he committed, making Israel to sin. I went back and tried to count this up, and I got 24 times where Jeroboam is referenced as a standard for sinfulness. How would you like that to be your legacy? Like, this is what you're famous for. The bad king that all other bad kings are measured by. In fact, it's Jeroboam's sinfulness that summarizes the entire period of the divided kingdom, ultimately leading to the destruction of first Israel and later Judah. When we disobey God, when we commit sin, kingdoms may not crumble as a result, but the effects can be long-lasting. There's a couple in our church, late 50s, early to mid 60s, very faithful, very active, but who long ago, at a time when their children were still young, they had a cabin at the lake. And weekend after weekend, they would go to the lake and spend good time with their family, but they would miss time worshiping with the church. As time passed, the kids grew up, moved out, had families and kids of their own. Parents grew older as well. They matured in their faith, as I mentioned. They're very, very faithful in their attendance. They're active in the church. They're leaders in our church. But where do you think those kids are? I'll tell you where they're not. They are not worshiping regularly. One doesn't worship at all. Another barely attends. The third is hit and miss. That pattern is now extended down to grandkids and another generation. Just, you know, a few years of making the decision to avoid the assembly of the church. Probably not even an active decision to avoid, just easier to do something else. And generations later, that sin has repercussions. A moment's harsh word can damage a friendship forever. A momentary lapse of integrity can tarnish a person's character indefinitely. Disobedience can have long-lasting effects. Jeroboam's life is a story of the long-lasting effects of disobedience. Number two, Jeroboam's life is a story of sacrificing principle for political expediency. Jeroboam's blessing, security, and power rested in his obedience to God. But instead of trusting in God, however, he chose to do the pragmatic thing. He made religious changes for political reasons, thinking that this would ensure his longevity as king, and instead it led to the downfall of his kingdom. And if there's a lesson that I think American Christians need to hear in 2017, a time of rampant political division and rabid political devotion. If there's a lesson that I think American Christians need to hear in 2017, it might be this one. Political power is not the means by which Christians are called to change the world. Political power is not the means by which Christians are called to change the world. Historically, in Churches of Christ, and in the American Restoration Movement, which we have historical ties to, we have an interesting and diverse relationship with politics. Alexander Campbell, a very early leader in the Restoration Movement, certainly the most influential in the first century or so, was very involved in politics. He served as a member of the Virginia Constitutional Convention in 1829 and 1830. James A. Garfield, the 20th President of the United States, was actually a Restoration Movement preacher. On the other hand, David Lipscomb, the longtime gospel advocate editor and a major leader in Churches of Christ in the South following the Civil War, was avowedly apolitical. He was a pacifist. He didn't think Christians should serve in the military or even vote. J.N. Armstrong, the first president of Harding College, was strongly influenced by Lipscomb, and he felt very similarly. I take this brief historical detour as a way of saying that in our own fellowship, we've had kind of this wide variety of views, and in the spirit of Romans chapter 14, I think that the Christian's relationship to politics is one of those disputable matters where we look at Scripture and we just try to do our best, and we don't judge other Christians as they do the same. Having said that, when it comes to politics, let us never sacrifice principle for political expediency. In the crisis of the moment, it might seem like a good thing to do, but as Jeroboam learned, it never pays off. I think Jeroboam's disobedience was largely based on fear. He was afraid of what would happen if he let the people go down and worship in Jerusalem. And so he made a politically expedient decision. In the last presidential election, I heard a lot of fear from Christians, regardless of their political views, regardless of where they were on the spectrum, about what was going to happen in the election. Now, I'm not a real controversial guy. I don't like controversy. As a guest speaker, I guess I can be a little more controversial because you can't fire me, and I'm going to leave town right after this is over, even though I'm just going to go about 5 miles away. But I'm not a controversial guy. I do not want to offend anyone by what I'm about to say, and I say it with no judgment toward you and any decision that you made, again, in the spirit of Romans chapter 14. In the last presidential election, just speaking for myself, I found myself unable to vote in good conscience for either party or either candidate from either major political party. Both candidates were well known. They'd been in the public eye for a long time. I felt like I knew who they were and what they were about. I did not respect the character of either candidate, and I just couldn't vote for them. Maybe you made a different choice, and that's fine. What really bothered me, though, was how often I was told or read from other Christians who supported one candidate or the other, because I got this from both sides of the political aisle, that I basically needed to ignore my principles and vote for the lesser of two evils, regardless of who that was, depending on the person I was talking to at the time. With the implication being that if I didn't, our next president could basically just end the world. You know, I don't care who you vote for, but it bothers me when Christians encourage one another to choose the lesser evil. Because I don't think we're supposed to choose evil in greater or lesser varieties. I don't care who you vote for, but it bothers me when Christians encourage one another to ignore their principles, because we are not supposed to be people who ignore our principles. I don't care who you vote for, but it does bother me when Christians suggest that the future hinges on some human ruler, because God is the one who is in charge. When Pharaoh ruled the world, God freed his people from Egypt. When Nebuchadnezzar ruled the world, God saved 3 Hebrew teenagers from a fiery death. When Caesar ruled the world, God resurrected his son from the dead and oversaw the greatest growth in the history of the Christian movement. It's up to you to choose what your relationship with politics will be. With all due respect to Brother Lipscomb, I would argue that our political voice is an opportunity that we have to glorify God. However, let us never make the mistake of thinking that political power is the means by which Christians are called to change the world, or that it's acceptable for us to sacrifice our Christian principles for the sake of political expediency. Number 3, last lesson. Jeroboam's life is a story of squandered opportunity. I think this is maybe the biggest lesson that we get from Jeroboam. We touched on this briefly before, but when you think about it, Jeroboam had not done anything to make himself be king. He was a good worker, but that doesn't guarantee anyone kingship. It was an act of God's grace that bestowed this position upon him. Also, if we pay close attention, we can see something interesting that the author of Kings is doing in the way he portrays Jeroboam. We tend to think of Solomon in largely positive terms. We think of his wealth and his wisdom, the fact that he built a temple, and we often minimize his unfaithfulness later in life when he married all of these foreign wives and turned away from following God. Some people even suggest that Solomon turned back to God later in life. That's usually based on the assumption that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes and that the end of the book represents Solomon's thinking late in life. But I think the narrative of Kings paints a darker picture. And if we look closely, we can see that in many ways, Solomon is portrayed as an unjust ruler who enriches himself by oppressing his people. He marries into the family of Pharaoh, and in some ways, he resembles the Pharaoh that enslaved the Israelite people in the days of Moses. That's why the people come to cry out to Rehoboam, "Hey, your father was too hard on us. Lighten our burden." But Rehoboam is determined to be even harsher than Solomon was. And then the narrator portrays Jeroboam as a Moses-like figure who is raised up by God, emerging from Egypt to free Israel from the oppressive rule of Solomon and Rehoboam. The story is arranged to give us hope. Maybe this is the guy who can get us back on the right track. What a great opportunity Jeroboam has. But it soon becomes clear that Jeroboam isn't the new Moses as much as he is the new Aaron, commissioning golden calves and ushering the people into idolatry. He's not going to get them on the right track. He's decidedly going to place the northern kingdom on the wrong track. What a wasted opportunity. He could have accomplished so much, but all he actually accomplished was to speed the downfall of the northern kingdom. What about us? Maybe none of us have been placed on thrones to rule nations, but in a variety of ways we've been given remarkable opportunities. Do we use those opportunities to serve God? We could probably come up with dozens of examples here. I'm just going to mention a couple. I know that our time is dwindling. Financial blessing. We live in a land of remarkable financial prosperity. Certainly there are people in our country who live in poverty, but most of us have more than we need. We also know, or we should know, that a basic biblical principle is that God blesses us so that we can be a blessing to others. Do we take advantage of the opportunities that God has given us to bless others, to give to the church, to give to the needy, to support missionaries? How often do you see, does God grant the blessing of a promotion or a new job with a pay raise, but rather than that leading to increased generosity and giving, it only leads to increased accumulation of stuff and increased commitment to the rat race? Or what about social media? You know, there's no biblical requirement that a Christian be on social media, and there are good reasons that could probably be made for just avoiding it altogether. But at the same time, the internet in general, and social media in particular, provide an unparalleled opportunity for regular people like you and me to promote certain ideas and messages and worldviews. How do we use that opportunity? Do we use it to encourage others and comfort others, and most importantly, to point others to Jesus? Or do you use it to spread gossip, stir up division, or even innocently post cat pictures? With just a little bit of reflection and creativity, I think we could spend just a few minutes and see that God has provided us with a lot of opportunities to do good. Do we make the most of these opportunities, or like Jeroboam, do we waste them? Jeroboam is one of the dark characters of the Old Testament. He's the man who made Israel to sin. Certainly someone we don't want to emulate, but his life does serve as a cautionary tale, teaching us lessons that we need to appreciate and apply to our own lives. And to recap, first lesson, Jeroboam's life is a story of the long-lasting effects of disobedience. Secondly, Jeroboam's life is a story of sacrificing principle for political expediency. And third, Jeroboam's life is a story of squandered opportunity. May God be with us as we seek to take these lessons, apply them to our own lives, and live lives that bring glory to Him. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here tonight and for your attention. And it's been great to be here, and I appreciate the invitation.